Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Holtzman against Terza. Mr. Pearson.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Stephen Pearson on behalf of Appellant Gregory Terza. Mr. Terza here in the courtroom this morning. We're here on appeal from an over $4.2 million judgment stemming from a single facsimile that was established to have been received by the lead plaintiff. There are four issues which I wish to cover this morning. One is the actual injury requirement of the TCPA. Two is that class certification was improper because common issues of fact did not predominate. Three, tribal issues of fact entitling my client to a trial on the issue of whether the primary motivating factor behind this facsimile was an advertisement. And four, whether the district court abused its discretion in awarding Cypre that was not requested by plaintiffs.
I have a procedural question that neither party has raised, which is, when was the notice required by Rule 23 to the class given, and how many class members opted out?
I know that approximately five opted out, Your Honor, and class notice, if you bear with me. It was at a date after November 9th, 2011, and I can give you that precise date.
It may be easier for the parties to submit supplemental memos. I'm interested in when it was given, how many opted out, and I assume the others have all submitted claims, or have there been some who have not submitted claims?
That status I'm not aware of, Your Honor, and would be a question that plaintiffs can
know that as well. Since the damages award in this case seems to have been calculated on the assumption that everyone submitted claims for all the facts as shown in the record, and that may or may not be what actually happened.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I'll also point out that in regard to the notice, there's no requirement in the notice that claimants actually establish actual receipt, therefore actual injury. So the case below proceeded on the premise that actual injury simply would flow directly from establishment of what I will call this new notion of successful sending. Plaintiff's counsel in their original complaint, amended complaint before the district court, despite their representation in their briefs before this court, initially asked for certification of a class who were sent these facsimiles. By modification of the court's ruling on class certification, on clarification on November 5 of 2009, the district court modified class certification to those who received. Plaintiffs in this appeal now contend that the case below always proceeded on the basis that receipt of faxes were required. That is simply not true. Plaintiffs have cleverly attempted and persuaded the district court to create this middle ground of successful sending of faxes, which is nowhere found in the statute. And it's our contention.
Successful sending of a fax is the same as receipt.
It's not.
What this record shows is that success is an indicator by the recipient's fax machine sent to the sending fax machine. That's what receipt means.
Agreed.
The fax machine says, I've got it. I'm done.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What else is required for receipt?
Proof of actual injury on the part of the...
No, there's no requirement to prove actual injury. The requirement is to show receipt.
And, in Your Honor...
The actual injury is only if you want regular damages. Otherwise, it's $500 a fax.
This concept of a virtual injury, which is effectively...
It's not a virtual injury. It's statutory damages in lieu of regular damages. But that's distinct from receipt. Could you explain to me how it is possible for the receiving fax machine to say, I've got it, without the fax having been received?
The question, Your Honor, we submit...
Could you explain to me how it is possible for the receiving fax machine to say, I've got it, without the facts having been received. Then, if you want, you can say, maybe I should ask a different question. But I'd like you to answer the question that I actually asked.
Fair enough. I cannot dispute that the handshake agreement reached between the two facsimile machines that are reflected in the record occurred. And Your Honor, that is the premise upon which the district court proceeded. Our position, however, Your Honor.
You could, I suppose, have put on a technical expert to say that there was some problem, but you didn't.
Mr. Canfield was put forward with respect to his theories, just as Mr. Biggerstaff's theories were with respect to erroneous reads as it related to the faxes that were sent. And Your Honor, our fundamental premise is that fax logs are not a surrogate for demonstration of actual injury. We read the statute as a remedial statute to require proof of actual injury. They're simply...
The statute doesn't say anything about injury.
Yeah, where are you getting that language from in the statute?
Just not
That's
there.
The second time you said that, and I don't... It's not in there.
Not there.
The statute is a remedial one, Your Honor. And
so what? Look, so if you say the statute requires X, you have to point to language in the statute requiring X. What the statute says is that if there's a receipt of a fax and the sending of the fax wasn't authorized, then $500 a fax.
The statute says recovery for actual monetary loss.
That's
from
not
such
what
a violation.
Quote me the language that says no recovery except for, quote, actual monetary loss.
Reading from Section 227B3, which provides for the private right of action for recovery for actual monetary loss.
Or?
Yes, I'm getting there, Your Honor. Or to receive $500 in damages for such violation, whichever is greater.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the floor is $500 for
right.
any violation?
Reading the statute as a whole, the floor is $500, but there needs to be a demonstration of an actual injury. If you
well, where do you get
say
the,
that?
Where do you get that language?
From the language actual monetary loss.
No. As it says well, you can recover for A or B. A is actual loss, and B is $500.
See,
it doesn't say the lesser of actual loss or $500. It says the greater.
Mm-hmm. Understood, Your Honor.
Okay. So I think you think or means and.
I think reading the statute as a whole, consistent with its legislative history, that this is a remedial statute, not a penal statute, requires a demonstration of actual injury. The premise of the statute is that there would be loss of ink, loss of paper. People would sustain an actual injury as a result of these unsolicited facsimiles. And Your Honor, again, this is not – we are simply requesting that Mr. Terza be given his right to trial on the issue. Ultimately, the credibility question with respect to
– right to trial on all disputed issues of material fact. What is the disputed issue of material fact? Unless you have some reason to believe that the receiving fax machine doesn't know when it's received a fax, there isn't any disputed issue of material fact.
Actually, I wish to disagree with Your Honor, because the experts called by plaintiffs and relied on by plaintiffs with respect to the system that was in use themselves offered their opinions with respect to what weight to be given to those fax logs. That in and of itself creates a tribal issue with respect to what mechanisms were employed, testing mechanisms were employed to determine whether those fax logs were accurate, resulted in false positives. The jury was entitled to hear from the lead plaintiff himself, who contended that he received 32 such faxes, but in reality could only offer evidence of one. And again, the basic premise of our contention, Your Honors, is that actual injury needs to be established under the statute. The statute is not a strict liability statute. It is remedial in nature. And for the plaintiffs, both Mr. Holzman and the class, to have standing to assert such a claim, they need to demonstrate an actual injury. And the fax logs, standing by themselves, get them to trial, but don't support an entry of judgment in the absence of trial. We're not suggesting summary judgment should have been entered in our favor. We are suggesting that material questions of fact were presented that went to the weight to be given to that evidence. I want to move to class certification very briefly, because our class certification argument is tied directly to the issue of individualized injury. And once again, there were significant proof questions with respect to the lead plaintiff himself, who contended that he received 32 such faxes, but had no actual evidence of receipt but for one. Those same proof issues exist and existed in this case with respect to every other class member. And the system that was employed by the district court, which allowed for a surrogate for actual evidence, which we contend should have been considered at trial, raised tribal issues of fact, and our client should have been entitled to bring these cases before a jury. I want to move to the advertisement issues, Your Honor. The district court on this issue moved from one end of the spectrum to the other end of the spectrum. His initial reaction to the Daily Planets was that these were not advertisements. They were not improper solicitations, and therefore were not in violation of the TCPA. The court ultimately reconsidered that determination, and in considering what the issue of whether the primary motivating factor behind the issuance of these facsimiles was a solicitation, was a commercial purpose. That again raised a material question of fact, even by the district court's own acknowledgement. And while his initial reaction was certainly not law of the case or binding, it is certainly reflective of what a reasonable jury could have concluded had they been presented with the evidence in this case with respect to the facsimiles that were sent that were alleged to be improper solicitations. The district court erred simply in this respect. Either the court should have considered the Daily Planet submissions on their face, considering each of the five factors that the FCC promulgated as a matter of law, and making a determination as a matter of law whether this was an improper solicitation, whether the primary purpose of it was an advertisement, or the court should have deduced facts to determine what Mr. Terza's primary purpose was. Instead, the district court commingled that exercise. And it's one or the other. It is either a matter of law or it's a factual question. And if it is a factual question, then on this issue as well, Mr. Terza was entitled to a trial. Material questions of fact, by the district court's own conclusion, existed with respect to the various factors. How much of this Daily Planet was devoted to an advertisement? It consisted simply of...
Why does it matter how much is devoted to educational materials and how much to an ad? If I open the New York Times and a quarter of the page is buy X at Macy's, and I then fax this page to somebody, the fact that 75% of the page is not asking you to buy at Macy's doesn't make it less an ad. It's still an ad, right?
The question becomes, what was the primary purpose? And if the primary purpose question,
where in the statute do you get this primary purpose business?
This is from the FCC's own regulation.
The statute. The FTC hasn't issued any regulations. The FTC has issued prosecutorial guidelines. It's issued guidelines for when it's going to bring prosecutions. We have to construe the statute. So where do you get primary purpose out of the statute?
The case law that has interpreted the statute.
Out of the statute. Where does it come in the statute?
I think, once again, Your Honor, reading the statute as a whole and the legislative history of the statute,
I hear something like, read the statute as a whole, the person is telling me, ignore the text of the statute and do something else. I'm asking a question about what the statute actually says. Is there something in the real statute, the enacted text on which you're relying?
The enacted text prohibits improper, unsolicited advertisements. The question of whether what was sent was an advertisement was a question of fact.
But it says specifically any material advertising such things. Any material. It doesn't say material that has more than 50% advertising content. It doesn't have any sort of tipping point. It says any material advertising, the commercial availability and so on.
And so
that's pretty broad.
It is admittedly broad. Responding to Geesterbrook's questions, I was relying on the case law that has interpreted it thus far, which the district court struggled with because there was a lack of guidance. On this record is a phone number, and a name and a photograph, and an office address, an advertisement. I think that is a triable issue on this record. The record evidence in this case and the arguments on appeal may well suit plaintiff's purposes for closing argument before a jury, but it presents squarely a tribal issue of fact as to whether this is to be considered an advertisement.
But it's more than just a name and a photograph and phone number. It describes the types of services, the type of practice that he has.
It what his background practice is in a corner of the ad. But remember, this is a lawyer who went to another lawyer for purposes of this marketing activity. And his state of mind.
So my marketing activity, you've given away the game.
I disagree.
That's what advertisements are. They're marketing activity.
Disagree. Well, we can't dispute for purposes of the record that this is an element of a marketing activity. Okay. But whether it is an advertisement prohibited by the statute is
a question. Depends on the language of the statute. And you are running away from the language of the statute as fast as your legs will carry you.
Your Honor, whether this was an advertisement is squarely presents a question of fact on this record. And the statute, again...
And what fact do you have that it's not an advertisement? What did you introduce?
This was an informational marketing newsletter. The same factors that the FCC promulgated are the same factors that the district court should have considered but not weighed ultimately in deciding whether he was persuaded as a trier of fact that this was in fact an advertisement and its primary purpose was not for informational purposes. Mr. Terza went to Mr. Riley, another lawyer, believing that this communication was legal and not prohibited. He should be entitled to tell that story. His state of mind is relevant to the tribal question of whether, in fact, this was an improper advertisement. The district court did not proceed by looking to the statute. The district court proceeded by instead looking to the factors promulgated by the FCC and the case law that has interpreted it. And, in fact, the case law that's interpreted is pretty much all over the blocks, depending on the particular facts and circumstances of the advertisement in question. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, and I'll reserve that to deal with the Cypre issue.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Mr. Bach.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, my name is Phil Bach. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff.
Mr. Bach, what do you know about the opt-outs and which class members have claimed receipt of how many faxes?
Notice was sent. I believe Mr. Pearson's correct that there were 5 opt-outs. The faxes attributable to them and the confirmation
how
reports
about
were
filing claims?
The claims process was going to be something when we're distributing the money. People would have to submit some sort of form to identify themselves as the owner of the fax number.
I think we need to discuss damages. We didn't get to that with Mr. Pearson. But if I understand the normal way in which people get damages, people submit claims, they'll file forms saying, I got so many faxes, and then the defendant will write them a check for $500 per fax received. The district court's model seems to be that the defendant writes a check to the judge, or perhaps to the clerk of court. The clerk of court sends some money out to some people, and then there's money left over, which the judge sends to his favorite charity. And I don't understand how we get there. I don't understand why the model isn't people submit claims, and the defendant writes checks to people who submit claims. And then there is no money left over. Right? So why isn't that the right model? You send the checks to the people who send their claims.
That's not the right model because it wasn't a settlement, and it's a class action.
Exactly. It wasn't a settlement. In a settlement, the terms of the settlement may be money is written to a class action administrator, and the administrator then sends out the money. And sometimes settlements say no reversion. But there isn't a settlement. There's no class action administrator. There is no pot created by a settlement. This is a contested class action. What I want to know is why, in a contested class action, we ever have anything other than the defendant writing a check straight to the class members.
The defendant wasn't willing to write a check to the class members, so we had to go to judgment.
The defendant isn't willing to write a check until it loses this appeal,
okay,
I assume. But the question I'm asking is, the district court enters a judgment that says, pay $4.2 million to me. I want to know why the proper judgment in a class action shouldn't say, pay $500 per fax to everybody who demonstrates receipt of the fax by submitting a claim. Why isn't that what the judgment should say?
Because we've already demonstrated receipt of the fax. The question is the identity of the people who owned the fax numbers.
Stop.
Okay.
Your client is the representative of a class. The damages are payable to the people who got the faxes. Your assumption, and the district court's assumption, is that the damages are payable to the class rather than the people who got the fax. I'm trying to figure out why the right model isn't that the damages are payable to the people who got the faxes.
That might be the correct model. What I was saying is we know who received the faxes, and we do have names and addresses, and the checks can be written. And the judge, when he entered judgment, he asked us to file something saying how we will administer the funds, and we did file that.
That's the problem. I don't see how we administer the funds ever gets in here without a settlement. In the absence of a settlement, it seems to me the money belongs to the class members, not to we.
I agree that it belongs to the class members, and I think the question or the point you're making is how do we put it in their hands? And they were notified about the case. They were notified that it would be resolved, and some of them opted out, and the rest of them are in.
Opted out, and apparently you tell me there hasn't been any procedure yet for the submission of claims. Let's suppose this were not a class action. Let's suppose this were a joint action under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and there were 20 or 100 employees who hadn't received their minimum wages. What would happen in that case? Would there be anything other than an order to cut checks to the individual plaintiffs? I don't think so. You don't say, pay X into the registry of court. The judge will now administer the funds. Mm-hmm. And if there's anything left over, the judge has now got a charitable contribution to make. You say, pay the injured people.
That could be done in this case. The judgment could say, pay the following amounts to the following people. We do have the list. But when Your Honor talked about people submitting claims, when these cases are settled, people don't come forward and say, yes, I remember receiving this junk fax 5 years ago.
If people don't submit claims, they don't get money. That's common whether the class action is settled or not.
Well, I don't know that
it seems to me that if somebody doesn't submit a claim, it doesn't mean the judge now gets to make a charitable contribution. It just means people haven't submitted a claim, so they don't get money.
Well, if we could take the charitable part and set it aside, assume there isn't anybody who doesn't take the money, and we have the names of 200 people, and we send them all the check for their share, and they all cash the check. There's no charity. There's no extra money or anything like that. We don't have any reason to believe there is going to be extra money. But the judge said, what if there is?
There won't be extra money if the model is that people who submit claims are paid directly by the defendant. There's only extra money when the model is pay the court or pay the plaintiff's lawyers or something like that. And as I say, if there's not a settlement that establishes that model, I don't understand the judge's authority to make the order pay the court as opposed to pay the recipient.
Well, there could be extra money even if you mail the checks to the people because you know their names. If they don't cash the check, what happens to that money? But there are other class actions. There might be $5 million.
In a Fair Labor Standards Act case, if the employer mails a check for the overtime pay to the worker and the worker doesn't cash the check, then the employer keeps the money, right?
I mean, some states, I think, would claim that the money belongs to them if it's not cashed, that it doesn't go back if it was awarded in a judgment. But
well, I think we can put this cheat to the side for the moment. This great state of Illinois may think it has more need for the money than the plaintiffs. But, of course, the district court's judgment denied the money to the state of Illinois, too. Maybe the district court's judgment is incompatible with status cheat laws, but that's a separate problem.
And there are class actions where the names of the class members aren't known, and those cases still, class certification has been affirmed, and those cases can go to judgment.
Yeah, but that's not the situation.
That's not the
situation. As I understand it, they're identified, everyone who got the facts. And so if they're getting their check cut, then there won't be any money left. I mean, you know, if you can identify them, they get the check, there's no money left. So essentially, they're filing a claim. It's a, quote, a legitimate claim, and there won't be any money left. You're saying that this order Gettleman entered was for any excess. And I think what Judge Easterbrook is trying to figure out is why that excess should go to the Cypre Fund. You know, it's a slightly different process in that all the claims have not been filed in advance, correct?
Right.
You have your opt-out people, but the people who are in the class have not filed their claim.
They have not.
Yet, because the process adopted here is that they will, when the funds become available, they'll file their claim, correct?
Well, we were...
And the judgment is entered, and the judgment is...
I don't know that claims are necessary, Judge. We already know who the people are. We know that they got how many faxes, how many they didn't get. We know the damages per fax, and we can just simply send them a check. So if they submit a claim form, it would be to confirm that, yes, they owned that fax number at the time in case the number had changed hands. But otherwise, there's not a reason for people to come forward and say, you know, I remember getting five junk faxes in 2006. Because people, this stuff is garbage that's not supposed to be sent, and it's thrown in the garbage. These people don't remember, they're not going to remember these things. There's no reason to remember them unless there's something offensive about it. But if you're getting 20 junk faxes a day and throwing them in the garbage can, 5, 6, 7 years later in a class action, you're not going to say, I remember those, and here I'll swear it under penalty. And nobody's going to have them saved somewhere. Here's my pile. So the proposal here would be that we just mail checks to these people. And Judge Gettleman said, well, what happens if you can't mail the checks to the person or it's not cash? What happens to the money? Suggest a Cypre entity, but... You know, the Cypre isn't.
By the way, any case in which an award, a judicial award to a charity, has been affirmed, other than a case where a settlement provided for that?
No. I mean, the Cypre, we don't
know. Or as you may know, both the First and the Ninth Circuits have recently held that this kind of relief is legally forbidden.
I am aware of that. And you know, we don't represent the Cypre.
In order to affirm this award, we'd have to go in the teeth. Quite a lot of law.
Well, only if there is Cypre. I don't know that there's any extra money to be going to Cypre because
there has never been a class action in the history of the world where everybody submitted a claim and every check has been cashed.
I agree. I mean, there really aren't very many class actions that go to judgment.
So you're not saying that you're opposed to only those who cash the check. I mean, that if a check is not cashed, it would. You're not opposed to that money going back to the defendant.
Right.
Right.
That's not
that, I mean, that's your bottom line, as I understand it. You're not trying to, you know, get extra money that, you know, to get money to put in the Cypre fund. So if people don't cash the check, the money will go back to the defendant.
I don't think we would object to that. We represent the class members, not some charity that...
And the Cypre was not your request.
Yeah.
We might have proposed the name. I don't remember, but Judge Gettleman asked us to.
But the concept, the concept came from the judge.
Yes.
Yeah, not from you.
Right. I mean, personally, I'm not opposed to charities or whatever, but that's not what we're doing here. This is about people, identifiable class members. Should they get their money? How do they get it? What happens? But it's, you know, I agree with Judge Easterbrook that the fact, you know, there probably will be some extra money. I don't know that for sure, but it's possible one of these class members went out of business. We can't find who they are.
And the money goes back to the defendant as far as you're concerned.
Yes. I mean, that's not my judgment, I suppose, but. I don't know if your honors have any other questions for me. I mean, the case is only about successfully sent faxes, which means received faxes. The defendant does not have any evidence to show that the fax transmission reports are not accurate.
Right, and those fax transmission reports show the frequency with which the faxes were sent.
Yes.
So it's easy to make that calculation.
It is. He argues that we've only got evidence that the plaintiff received one, but the defendant said that people had complained and been removed from the list, so he knew they were getting them. He was paying every month for it. Two of the opt-outs said they had received them. Judge Gettleman permitted the defendant to draft and send questionnaires to every class member. They didn't offer any evidence about the responses to those. He permitted them to depose some of the class members. They didn't offer. So this, the question of whether the faxes were received is not something they can seriously raise. They were received. The case was limited to receipt. Regarding the advertisements, the statute does say if you advertise the availability or quality of services, every one of these faxes either talked about the guy's services that he offers or seminars that he was selling, and even in defendant's reply brief to this court, they say the point of them was to establish his reputation in the community as an estate planning expert. So that is them saying he was sending them to show the availability and quality of his services as an estate planning lawyer. And you know,
how, by the way, was that going to happen when what he was sending was drivel?
I don't know.
This wasn't stuff that he wrote. I mean, I know a lot of law firms where the top lawyers at the firm write specific advice for clients about problems they're having and send it out. But these things were just drivel.
I mean, right. Were they good advertisement? You know, it's sort of like in the Super Bowl, there's some commercials that are good and some that everybody scratches their head, and they all still cost $1 million a minute or whatever. But I don't know. I think Your Honor made a good point when you said there's nowhere in the statute does it say the percentage of the facts is the relevant question to whether it's an ad or not. And I think in this case the defendant admitted that they're advertisements, and the guy who is drafting these things did make this distinction between marketing and advertising because he thinks it's marketing and not advertising. But he really never could explain why that was a difference with a significance. And he said it was only because he didn't want to run afoul of lawyer advertising rules, which are, you know, as we said in our brief, apply to advertising for a particular matter, not just this general sending it out. If you don't have any other questions for me, I can finish here.
Thank you, Mr. Bach. Anything further, Mr. Pearson?
Only to say that the questions from the panel covered my argument with respect to the Cypre issue. It is correct that the issue was raised by the district court, and in response to requests from the district court, plaintiff's counsel provided the suggested Cypre recipient. There was no mechanism established by the district court for how the claims process would actually work, and to my knowledge, that has not yet occurred, which is the reason why I was unable to give the panel a more precise answer in that regard. I don't know what the district court had in mind in that regard, but it would follow logically that only those who make claims ought to receive money pursuant to class action structure. And unless the panel has any further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pearson.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement.